The Safari Park.
You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hands off to Larry.
Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name, buried in cheers and applause? I think not. Here we are looking down the barrel of another Labor Day weekend. But do they ever compare to Memorial Day or 4th of July? Hell no. As a kid, Labor Day was just a two-word condensation of the shittiest phrase in the English language. Back to school. Even the name, Labor Day, it's redolent with commie overtones. And commies are the gloomiest shitbags on earth. All they're good at is being miserable, rigid assholes. Fuck 'em all. As a kid, summer vacation started around Memorial Day and always ran at least until Labor Day. 10 glorious, homework-free, test-free, authoritarian-free, anxiety-free, and bullshit-free weeks of freedom. Wake up in the morning, pull on your jeans, lace up your PF Flyers, wolf down some Cocoa Puffs or other sugar-soaked empty calories, and explode out the front door to adventure. We never really had to look for it. You just hit the street, and somehow your friends would magically be there. No advance notice needed. And in just a few moments, a game of stickball or I declare war, in which the racial and ethnic epithets would fly like buckshot, and also magically, nobody gave a shit, or was the slightest bit offended. Sometimes a kid would flash on an abandoned house, somewhere. There always seemed to be one in reasonable proximity, and we'd trudge over there to see if there was any unbroken glass yet to be shattered. Abandoned houses were always a blast, and of course somebody had heard there was a chest full of money in the attic or basement, and we'd search the place from top to bottom. The only thing Tom and Huck had that we didn't was the Mississippi River. We had a shitty little version of it, Newtown Creek. It's an estuary of the East River, which, quite possibly, may be the most polluted body of water on the planet. Swimming was out of the question. Building a raft for it was unnecessary, as it was so thick with filth and debris you could easily hopscotch across the surface. The stench would clear your sinuses like a wad of wasabi. So sometimes we'd trek over to the creek, which formed part of the border between Brooklyn and Queens, just to see what might be floating in it. Dog carcasses were always a guarantee. Somebody claimed to have seen a human hand float up through the sludge and disappear again, like at the end of Deliverance. But that sighting was never confirmed. It's not much of a creek, only winds 2 or 3 miles, but they figure it contains at least 30 million gallons of spilled oil. They've checked, and the layer of sludge on the creek bed runs as deep as 25 feet. If they dredged that thing, they'd surely come up with Judge Crater, Jimmy Hoffa, and King Tut's treasure. There was a psychotic guy from my older brother's class who, one night after dinner near the creek with his sister and mom, got pissed off at them and drove the three of them into that creek in his car, a la Thelma and Louise. What a way to go, face first into that toxic gunk in a Chevy. But that's a story for another show. So how did I get from Labor Day to drowning in a toxic creek?
Larry, stay on task!
Okay. So since Labor Day is nigh, what better time to address some concerns of our esteemed listeners regarding their careers? Yeah, work is a necessary evil, and it's just criminal how many assholes have to make it more evil than it is. First off, I want to get to a dude who calls himself Nippon Nick. Love that handle. Here's what Nick has to say. Hey, Larry, love the show. I feel your show gives me the worldly advice my uncles should have, but were either too drunk, dead, or not present to give. Thanks for your advice. As a member of the Patreon-y dojo, I thought it was time to send in a question that probably doesn't apply only to my situation, but to many others who have found themselves stuck by circumstance. A bit of background. I'm approaching 30, and have spent the last several years in Tokyo, where I have acquired, either by my own means or work of the devil, a great job, a pointy chick, and a fairly comfortable life. Personally and professionally, this place has in many ways been great for me. However, Japan is a pretty rigid society. Long hours, rife depression, and not a great deal of communication going on. It's where the national hobby seems to be flinging yourself into oncoming trains or off tall buildings. This country, like a bad job, toxic vampire, or girlfriend, is comfortable but hard to leave, and ultimately, I know it's not good for me. My TNS question is, how do you know it's time to get the hell out? What is the critical point that you take your ball and leave? Yours in refusing to take shit? Nippon Nick. Well, Nick, first of all, thanks for listening and thanks for supporting the show. I've no idea how you're employed in Japan, but sir, you are a powerful scribe, a definitely professional caliber. Your email is unique in execution, but as you surmised, your dilemma is somewhat common, especially in dudes who've just glimpsed 3 decades in their rearview mirror. 30 is a milestone year for all of us. Plenty of ladies wake up that morning and say, shit, I forgot to get married and have babies. And so guys, whether they're in the midst of a thriving career or struggling to kickstart one, when we reach 30, something happens to us. We are seized by feelings of what? Is it discontent? A gnawing notion that we may be missing something. Maybe we've acquired some of the trappings of success, a set of wheels, a decent crib, maybe a few toys with chrome foot pegs or ape hangers, or maybe something with a V-hull and twin Mercs. But still, is this all there is? Are we doing what we really wanted to do? Are we working to live or living to work? We would all love to bear out the old bromide. If you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. Plenty of us grow up wanting to be star athletes or just plain stars. And at 30, the odds of making those fantastic dreams a reality suddenly look very small indeed. Sure, George Foreman was heavyweight champ at 45, but that was only because he'd already been heavyweight champ at age 24. And pick your entertainment star. Rare is the Rodney Dangerfield who only came into his own as a middle-aged guy. 30 hits us in the face pretty hard, and we begin to question everything. What are we doing? Why are we doing it? Is this why we're here? Lucky are the few who have a clear calling in life. Most of us just try to get by. We try a job here, another one there, hoping one will fit and seem right. But more often than not, we just punch a clock and grind it out, living for 5 o'clock, or 8 or 9 o'clock. Oh, and the weekends, and thanks to our digital tethers, those are often eroded by work as well. Before 30, time seems limitless, where the notion of wasting it never really enters our minds. But at 30, no one can any longer be considered or called a kid. We're expected to have found our footing and be well entrenched in whatever the hell we're supposed to be doing in life. Ha. Let's start with Nick's location. I've never been to Japan, so I can't speak to that issue with any authority, but clearly Nick is a Westerner visiting. I've really only lived in New York or L.A., two massive cities in the same nation, yet the cultural differences between those two places are vast. And though I've lived in L.A. for a long time, I still miss plenty about New York and New Yorkers. So I cannot begin to imagine what Nick might be feeling, or anyone living in a place so foreign. Maybe we're all part salmon. Sooner or later, we just want to go home. But I've been there and done that. After a few years in LA, I was transferred back to New York, and ambivalent about it, but for the first few weeks, it felt great to be home. After many nights of backslapping with old friends in even older saloons, I found myself deep in the environment I had fled several years earlier. Riding subway cars packed in with humanity in a heat and stagnant air that was worse than cattle cars. How bad was it? Nick, permit me to digress for a moment and give you an illustrative and true story. I was riding the subway on a steaming summer day. The air conditioning in them more often was broken than not, and the heat was just insufferable. And as on crowded elevators, the protocol on subways is, even though you are close enough to people to have sex with them, you must not meet their eyes, because they might be psychos and stab you, or you may have to talk to them, and nobody wants to do that unless it's a pointy chick, and then you do want to talk to her, but she's got earbuds and her eyes are closed, so the keep away sign is flashing red neon. So I'm on this incredibly unpleasant subway train and hanging on to an overhead grab bar. Not so much to keep from falling down, because it was so crowded you could not possibly fall down, but rather to allow some airflow into my dripping armpits. And I look at the guy's arm next to me. It was a pretty old arm, and on it is a strange tattoo. It was just 5 or 6 digits in blue ink. And I looked at it and wondered, what is that? His kid's birthday, or the day he quit drinking, or his lucky numbers? And then it dawned on me what it could be. And I looked at the man's face, and he'd been watching the entire tableau on my face, and he looked slightly amused, and he said, "Yes, young man, those numbers are what you think they are. I was a guest at Auschwitz." I was speechless. And then he told me that when they took him from his home and placed him on the train to Auschwitz with thousands of others, that train trip en route to a death camp was far more pleasant and humane than the one we now shared on the New York City subway. Again, I could say nothing. And he said, "Young man, get the hell out of this city, or make enough money that you never have to ride these goddamn subways, because this is no way to live, not even for a little while each day." And I thanked him for the advice, and he said, "God bless you." And my stop was there, and I pushed my way through the crowd and exited the train. So it's not just what you're doing, but where you're doing it. And when working away from home, it's a balance between the rewards of the job versus the emotional toll of homesickness. Sounds like Nippon Nick is feeling that disquiet. And here's the real catch, Nick. While there's never a definitive point of no return, there is a point where return becomes problematic. Once you buy property, it's not as easy to leave. You have a pointy woman, but you don't say if she is local. If you leave Tokyo, does she leave with you? The longer you stay and stay with her, the more difficult it will be to depart. And then, after a number of years, you can reach a point of no return. Not that you are incapable of leaving, but something happens that we never, ever foresee until it does happen. And when it does, that realization envelops us like a lead blanket. Home no longer really is home. The people you left behind move on to other places and different lives. Your pals or siblings are no longer there because they've relocated, or they have families and just aren't as available as they once were. Or maybe you grow and change in ways you never anticipated, and those friends just don't seem to be in lockstep with you as they once were. When that happens, Nick, it's a shitty feeling. There's an old Neil Diamond song that covers it very well, and the money lyric is this. L.A.'s fine, but it ain't home. New York's home, but it ain't mine no more. Those lyrics have a lot of meaning for me, and you can substitute any location, and they'll still be just as valid. So nip on Nick, though you surely seem a dude who has it together, I cannot say that I envy you at this point in your life. You really stand at a crossroads, and you must choose. Evaluating some key factors may help you make the right choice. When I left New York, there was really very little holding me there. But maybe you have a lot of family you love, back home. And about this job that provides you your comfy lifestyle, does it travel? Is there a possibility of a similar one back home? Are the skills you've acquired portable? And your pointy companion, can you see yourself with her for the long haul, or is she temporary? These are tough questions, my friend. You can sit down with a ledger and carefully demarcate the pros and cons of living in each place. But that's not going to help you make the most important decision. Where does your heart lie? For that, I'd suggest some alone time and heavy-duty reflection and contemplation. Imagine yourself, not 30, but 40, or even 50, still in Tokyo. Your family and friends back home may have dwindled significantly in those years. Are you and your pointy friend now a family? And does that picture look good? Or does it leave a hollow longing in your gut and a lump in your throat? Because if you do get that lump, no amount of money or toys or prestige or job satisfaction will ever smooth it out. You in some way have answered your own question, Nick, when you say, quote, ultimately I know it's not good for me, unquote. But you must still be uncertain, or you would not have asked. Most creatures thrive in places for which they are designed. St. Bernards aren't built for the desert, and palm trees don't do well in tundra. And people aren't all that different. No matter how good the sushi, sooner or later, the Englishman wants his bangers and mash. Nick, I hope this helps you sort out your feelings. Let me know your decision, and the time to make it is soon. This next listener is facing a situation not too far afield from Nick's. His name is Don, and he writes thusly. Larry, I work in PR and marketing, which I'm good at, but not entirely satisfied with. Probably more to do with company culture and salary, more than the field itself. I run an online operation, always hustling to make money, and it's good, but incredibly time-consuming. I'm beginning to value my time more than my money. Been considering law school since childhood, but I'm scared of the ROI it offers. I also know the older I get, the harder it's going to be. I'm pushing 30. I've hit my limits at this company, and it's time to move on. And I'm tired of Japanese business culture. On the other hand, I've been thinking about just looking for another job with better pay and company culture. I know if I found an environment that weren't so toxic, I wouldn't hate getting up in the morning. What would you do in my shoes? Wow, looks like nobody wants to work for the rising sun. I used to deal with a number of Japanese corporations, the biggest of the big. And before I took on those accounts, I had a lengthy dinner with a guy who'd been working with these companies for many years. This guy really knew his shit and tightened me up with a heap of good advice. But the one chunk of wisdom he laid on me was that their corporate culture was hyper-hierarchical. Way, way more than that of American companies. As he put it, for them, you are either their boss or their boy. There is no shoulder-to-shoulder working relationships. If you take any shit at any time, they'll regard you as a chump forever. That was pretty damn true. And according to Nick and Don, it seems it still is. So Don, Just as poker players usually have a tell, so do people writing letters, and yours is very clear. If you, quote, hate getting up in the morning, unquote, you need a fucking change, and fast. But what change? If a career in law has always been your dream, by all means, pursue it with vigor. But if it's just an escape from your current situation, don't. Hollywood makes law look pretty appealing, doesn't it? Tom Cruise gets Jack Nicholson on the stand and grinds him into sawdust and then takes Demi Moore home. I once considered a law career, so I took some courses and the LSATs. Was even accepted to a couple of law schools. And at every step of the way, I had a knot in my gut that never stopped twisting. I hated every second of it. I found most law unbearably boring. But some people don't, and they make great attorneys. So maybe you get a taste of it first before you make any permanent decisions. Here's something that will help you immensely, Don. Once you make the decision to bail on your current job, you'll find yourself released from the paralysis that a miserable situation sometimes creates. Just knowing that you are plotting an escape will embolden you to move forward. So throw down that gauntlet to yourself and set a date by which you will be free of your job. Even if it's a lateral move, that's okay, as long as it gets you out of the daily hell. I've no doubt Don will succeed because he's not afraid to ask for what he wants. He has the audacity to ask two questions. He follows up his career question with one from the romance department. Don has himself a girlfriend who is, quote, sweet, caring, loyal, and the chemistry is nice, but may come in a bit shy on the intellectual side. Am I putting too much value on intelligence? I've dated smart gals that just let that inflate their ego. Well, this Don guy just wants it all, doesn't he? Sweet, caring, loyal, and a nice chemistry. As opposed to some Mensa babe who is sour, self-centered, untrustworthy, and puts your teeth on edge. How could one possibly decide? All kidding aside, Don, no, you can't put too much value on intelligence, but I'm willing to bet this chick is not the one. Because when you do meet the one, you'll find you cease to measure her pros and cons like you're purchasing an automobile. When you meet the one, you'll find you can't bear the thought of life without her, and you'll want to be with her as much as you'll want to take your next breath. Of course, that's the Jedi mind tricks chicks play on guys, because even though you feel that way, she'll be sizing you up like a professional appraiser, earning potential, gene pool, are you good with kids, etc., etc. But that's how it works, my friend. Thanks for listening and writing, Don, and let me know your decision on both issues. It's been great to hang with all of you once again. You know, we never vacation here at the Take No Shit Dojo, but for the next couple of weeks, we may throttle back just a touch with slightly abbreviated episodes before we come roaring back with the heavy artillery that might just include the Spumante Chronicles. So come hang with us each Tuesday. And if you like what you just heard, pop over to iTunes and drop 5 stars on us. If you've got a problem, we've got a sensei at the dojo who can help. So email us at thatlarryshow@gmail.com. Just about simultaneous with the posting of this episode, we'll be dropping a bonus episode at patreon.com/thatlarryshow. So slide over there and join the dojo. It's a terrific crew. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram. It's all pretty much the same address, That Larry Show. And so, my friends, as you approach the crossroads of your life, take the path that feels right in your gut. Because all too often, when we look back at those pro and con ledgers, we find out we've cooked our own books. You don't want to find yourself up Newtown Creek. I'll see you next Tuesday, right here at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. And until that time, take no shit.